Ukrainian forces strike a key Russian supply bridge spanning the Dnipro River.
Ukrainian officials said that this was the last proposition, basically, for the Russian forces to leave.
Plus a look at the U.S. Justice Department's efforts to hold those accountable who commit war crimes.
The Justice Department is in close contact with our partners in Ukraine, but also elsewhere in the world on how we can best help with their investigation and prosecution.
And later in the program, an aid center in Poland gets a little extra help from some big stars. Today is Wednesday, July 27th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. Ukrainian forces struck the Antonivsky Bridge that was spanning the Dnipro River. A Russian official said that the bridge, while still standing, was full of holes. The bridge is a key link, allowing Russia to supply its forces in southern Ukraine. And Anna Chernikova joins us to share more about what's known following the attack.
Ukrainian officials said that this was the last proposition, basically, for the Russian forces to leave, because as deputy of head of president office, Mr. Podolyak said that next time Russian forces would actually be cut. So basically, Ukrainian forces are trying to, you know, give this hint to the Russian side that they actually have probably a plan to continue the attacks or to do something additional so that this bridge could not be used at all.
And speaking of the Kherson region, it does appear as if Ukrainian forces, as part of their counteroffensive measures, have been able to recapture some villages that were previously under Russian occupation. But I want to turn our attention to the front line, because the mayor of Kharkiv said that Russia attacked some of its city infrastructure with S-300 missiles. Now, that's something that VOA cannot independently verify. But what can you share with us about what's known about additional fighting on the front lines?
Russian forces definitely continued their own attacks as well, not only in Kherson region, but of course in the east. In terms of the east part of Ukraine, situation is not that much different from what we see for the past couple of days. The most heavy fightings are happening in the area of Bakhmut, and today the city of Bakhmut was attacked by the Russian forces with missiles. So today early in the morning, Russian forces hit the territory and the building of the hotel in Bakhmut. For the moment, we know about 4 people injured and 1 people killed. But rescue operation is going on, and the numbers could change. The Kharkiv region is also under the attack, though the territory next to Chuhuyev, which is in the middle of Kharkiv and Izum, also the city of Mykolaiv, which is in the south and which is the closest region to Odessa region, continuously under the fightings and under the attacks, missile attacks. We know that people continue to evacuate from Mykolaiv region to Odessa region when it is possible. In terms of casualties, we don't have confirmed numbers from over the night, but we know that shelling was happening and some damages were reported. Again, as the Institute for Study of War said in one of their latest reports, Russian forces are trying to decide which either east part or south part to concentrate their forces at.
Anna Chernikova reports for us from the capital, Kyiv, Ukraine. Anna, thank you very much for your time today. Be sure to visit voanews.com/flashpoint for additional updates on Ukraine 24 hours a day. State-controlled media outlet RT on Wednesday lost its court fight against the European Union ban it imposed back in March due to its systemic disinformation over Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov responded harshly to the ruling. Peskov called Moscow's reaction extremely negative, as well as an attack on the freedom of speech and on press freedoms in European states. He added that Russia would continue to take similar measures on Western media operating within its borders, and that Moscow would look to find loopholes that would enable it to resume broadcasting in Europe. VOA's Henry Ridgewell shares what may be next for the state-controlled broadcaster.
RT had argued to the General Court in its application that the sanctions were discriminatory on the basis of nationality, on the basis that these sanctions targeted only Russian-speaking broadcasters, and therefore they broke EU rules on discrimination. Now, the judges in the General Court dismissed that appeal and said that the measures were proportionate given the circumstances. The European Union put these sanctions in place following the Russian invasion of Ukraine in February, of course, soon after that invasion took place. Now, the General Court is the second highest level, really, of jurisdiction in the EU. What RT and the Russian state could do is appeal to the European Court of Justice, which is the bloc's most senior legal body. It could bring a similar case arguing that the sanctions are discriminatory, or it could look at other legal avenues to try to get them dismissed, possibly looking at issues of freedom of speech. We don't know yet if Russia will do that.
Has there been any discussions as to what perhaps Peskov meant by seeking loopholes that would allow RT to continue broadcasting?
The Kremlin and Dmitry Peskov have not expanded on what he meant by those loopholes, and neither has the European Union responded with any idea of what it might see as a way around this ruling. There is some speculation that Peskov could be talking about potential technological ways, loopholes around banning RT. So are there satellite platforms, are there internet platforms where RT could broadcast into the European Union, reach consumers in the European Union without breaking these sanctions, without having to operate within the continent, within the EU's jurisdiction?
Henry, gas began flowing through the Nord Stream 1 pipeline from Russia into Germany at 18% today. Now, this was widely expected and comes a day after EU ministers met and voluntarily agreed to reduce reliance on Russian gas by 15%. So on this first day of reduced flow, how are things going?
What we're seeing so far is European governments urging consumers, and particularly urging industry, to cut their gas use to try to avoid rationing and shortages of gas further down the line. At the moment, it's midsummer in Europe. It could be a very different picture come October, November, when households start turning on their heating and gas demand soars, and the gas storage systems at the moment are only running at around 60% in Europe. Europe hopes to fill those up ahead of the winter, but with supplies down in pipelines like Nord Stream 1 below 20%, it's obviously going to be very difficult to do that.
Do officials believe that they can hit the required targets?
There is speculation as to whether that 15% voluntary cut will be enough to replenish those storage systems across Europe. Of course, it's not only Russia that Europe gets its gas from. It gets it from all over the world. There are pipelines coming in from Armenia through Turkey, from Africa via Algeria beneath the Mediterranean. There are shipments of liquefied natural gas coming in, particularly from the United States at the moment and Qatar. And Europe is working very hard to boost those supplies. But of course, the problem is it's a global gas market and it's competing against other gas consuming nations around the world. And the price of that gas is increasing all the time. I think there is a recognition that at the moment, this is an initial step by Europe, a tentative step, because the rationing of gas and the reduction of gas is a very sensitive subject, which could have a big impact on national economies in Europe. And it's also an issue that could reveal splits within Europe, a bloc that has so far remained united against Russia. But there are signs of divisions when it comes to issues like reducing gas. Countries like Hungary are very reluctant to sign up to any EU-wide deal on banning Russian gas entirely. So I think there are political reasons and economic reasons why the EU so far hasn't gone further. we will see later in the year whether further mandatory cuts are necessary.
From London, VOA's Henry Ridgewell. Henry, thanks.
Thanks so much, Steve. Good to speak to you.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. Earlier this year, the Biden administration said that it would work with partners to hold Russia accountable for alleged war crimes committed throughout its most recent invasion of Ukraine. VOA Justice Department correspondent Masoud Farivar recently had the opportunity to speak with Eli Rosenbaum.
I'm the counselor for war crimes accountability for the Department of Justice, but my day job is I'm director of human rights enforcement strategy and policy in the Justice Department criminal division's human rights and special prosecutions section.
And Christian Levesque.
I'm the lead prosecutor for the war crimes accountability team. I'm also a trial attorney for the human rights and special prosecution.
And we begin with part one of their conversation.
So, Mr. Rosenbaum, you have spent decades investigating and prosecuting Nazi war criminals. You're best known as a Nazi hunter. Tell us about the parallels you see between that work and your current job investigating Russian war crimes and how that experience has shaped your view of why this effort is so important today.
Well, the many years, even decades for some of us, that my HRSP colleagues and I have worked on human rights violator and war criminal cases have, I believe, prepared us exceptionally well for this crucial mission at this fateful time. It is almost as though all of the work we've done has prepared us for this very moment. We have a wealth of expertise in international criminal law, vast experience actually proving in courts of law the complicity of defendants who participated in atrocity crimes, a long established array of partnerships and contacts with law enforcement authorities here, for example, at FBI and HSI, and also abroad, authorities that specialize in these kinds of cases. We have heightened sensitivity born of decades of working with survivors of atrocity crimes to the imperatives of demonstrating sensitivity to the traumas that they've experienced and treating surviving victims with respect at all times and doing what we can to connect them to resources as needed and appropriate. Fundamentally, this new mission is a continuation of the one that I have been privileged to be a part of for over 35 years at the Department of Justice.
Having investigated numerous Nazi cases, you must know a Nazi when you see one. So when President Vladimir Putin of Russia says that Russian forces were sent to Ukraine to denazify the country, what do you say to that?
Yes, I would say after nearly 40 years of working on these cases, I can recognize a Nazi when I see one, and I know a Nazi government when I see one, and of course the Ukrainian government is nothing of the sort. It's an outrageous calumny, and it it's being used to justify inhumane actions as part of an unlawful war of aggression launched by Russia.
Now, let's talk about your current work on Russian war crimes investigations. My understanding is that the Justice Department is both providing support to Ukrainian and ICC investigators, as well as conducting its own investigations of possible war crimes. How are you coordinating with your Ukrainian and European counterparts, and what types of war crimes are you investigating? Christian?
The Justice Department is in close contact with our partners in Ukraine, but also elsewhere in the world, on how we can best help with their investigations and prosecutions. We're obtaining assistance in our own investigations, in our own investigative work as well. We're also committed to providing assistance through the Human Rights and Special Prosecution section, which is within the Department of Justice's Criminal Division. That's the section that both Eli and I work within, but also through other Justice Department components as well. There's really quite a group of organizations and agencies that are connected here, including the International Criminal Investigative Training Assistance Program, also known as ISATAP. That's within the Department of Justice.
the Office of Overseas Prosecutorial Development, Assistance and Training, or OPDAT, also within the Department of Justice, and the Office of International Affairs within the Department of Justice, as well as law enforcement such as FBI and HSI. And there are several ways that we are showing this coordination, which includes that in very recently, less than 2 weeks ago, the Justice Department participated in a ministerial conference in The Hague, in which Ukraine, the United States, and 43 other nations got together and formally announced in a publicly released declaration, they announced our unified commitment to ensuring accountability for international crimes committed in Ukraine and to enhancing collective action to promote accountability for such crimes. So our strong support abroad for our partners abroad really reflects the public commitment that the Attorney General has made during his recent trip to Ukraine. And there he declared that the U.S. Justice Department will pursue every avenue of accountability for those who commit war crimes and other atrocities in Ukraine, and that working alongside our domestic and international partners, the department will be relentless in our efforts to hold accountable every person complicit in the commission of war crimes, torture, and other grave violations during the unprovoked conflict in Ukraine. Now, I think you also asked about what are the kinds of war crimes that we are looking at, because as you noted, the Attorney General has said publicly in June, on June 21st, that the department does have ongoing investigations into potential war crimes over which the U.S. has jurisdiction. And that includes the killing and wounding of U.S. civilians, including journalists who are covering, again, the unprovoked Russian aggression in Ukraine. So our U.S. war crime statute covers grave breaches of the 1949 Geneva Conventions, among other violations. And as a result, that is a priority for investigators in the U.S.
We'll have more of Masoud's conversation with the Justice Department's Director of Human Rights Enforcement Strategy and Policy, Eli Rosenbaum, and Lead Prosecutor for the War Crimes Accountability Team, Christian Levesque, tomorrow. Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, lashed out at Western countries on Wednesday as he wrapped up a four-nation trip to Africa with a stop in Ethiopia's capital. Moscow is seeking to bolster support from African countries who have largely declined to condemn Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Lavrov's visit comes as the United States announced nearly $500 million of additional aid for drought relief in Ethiopia. Fred Harder has the details.
At a Wednesday news briefing in Addis Ababa, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov denied Western assertions that his country's invasion of Ukraine is responsible for the global surge in food prices. Lavrov said prices were rising before Russia invaded Ukraine in February due to the COVID-19 pandemic and what he called green policies pursued by the West. He also claims that any additional increases in grain prices were the result of American and European sanctions on Russia.
I know that the Western media presents the situation in a totally distorted manner, if only to mention the food crisis, so-called food crisis, as if nothing was of concern before February this year.
Lavrov is on the last leg of an Africa tour that has included Egypt, Uganda, and the Republic of the Congo. He has sought to reassure regional leaders that grain exports through Ukraine's Black Sea ports will resume, while pinning the blame for their halt on the West. Lavrov alleged Wednesday that the sanctions imposed on Russia are a sign that the United States wants a return to what he called a colonial world order.
The West created a system which was based on certain principles: free market, fair competition, sanctity of the private property, presumption of innocence, something else. All these principles have been thrown down the drain when they needed to do what they believe is to punish Russia.
While in Addis, Lavrov met with the Ethiopian Foreign Minister, Demeke Mekonnen. The pair agreed to strengthen cooperation and economic ties, according to state media. There is no indication that Lavrov met with Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, who has not been seen in public lately, or with officials from the African Union headquarters in Addis Ababa. AU officials told VOA that Lavrov's stop was a bilateral visit between Russia and Ethiopia. Earlier Wednesday, the US government announced a package of $488 million to help Ethiopia with drought relief efforts. Dry weather and conflict have left 30 million Ethiopians in need of aid. Announcing the new funds, Tracy Ann Jacobson, the US Charge d'Affaires in Ethiopia, said weather conditions across the region were the worst in recorded history. The new US Special Envoy for the Horn, Mike Hammer, is expected to arrive in Ethiopia on Wednesday, his first visit to the country, where the US is supporting efforts to mediate between the federal government and rebels from the Tigray region in the north. Fred Harter for VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
When Russia invaded Ukraine, Ukrainian business owners united to open an aid hub in Poland that's called the Help Ukraine Center. There, Ukrainian refugees as well as international volunteers, including some big-name stars, worked tirelessly to process aid that's sent in from all around the world. VOA's Miroslava Gongadze rounds us out.
This is the Help Ukraine Center in Lublin, Poland, where about 150 volunteers work daily to sort, pack, and deliver humanitarian and medical aid to Ukraine as Russia continues its war on the country. Colton Smith, a volunteer from California, has been helping here for 2 months.
I have had no closer connection with any conflict in my life as I have with the war in Ukraine. I've been following the developments that have been happening ever since the revolution back in 2014. And I couldn't stand by while what was going on. As I continued to do my job back in California, when the invasion broke out, my heart shattered and I couldn't smile.
Volunteers include Ukrainian refugees, too. They left behind jobs, friends, families, hobbies, and plans for their futures. Now they are here helping those who stayed behind. Coordinator Olga Rudneva says Ukrainian businesses, big and small, united to open the center.
And we are running here since March. We have the 900 volunteers who are ready to join us anytime. And we have another 40 people approximately every day who come here to sort humanitarian aid. So what we actually do, we gather all humanitarian aid sorted here by categories from Europe and non-EU countries as well.
In collaboration with Ukrainian government, they deliver aid to Mariupol, Mykolaiv, Chernihiv, Kharkiv and many other Ukrainian centers where people need immediate help. Coordinators say so far the center has delivered over 6,000 tons of humanitarian aid to Ukraine. Well-known figures also joined the effort, like the winners of the 2022 Eurovision Song Competition, the Ukrainian music rap group called Kalush Orchestra. The group volunteered a few hours before leaving to perform at the charity concert in Lublin to support the operation.
We came to the biggest volunteer center in Europe to see it, say thank you and help.
Exhausted but happy, the musicians and volunteers together sing Stefania, the group's song, which has come to represent Ukrainian refugees. The groups uplift each other with words to stay strong and united for Ukraine's future. Miroslava Gongadze, VOA News, Lublin, Poland.
And that's going to do it for us today. Be sure to stay up to date with the latest developments not only in Ukraine, but news and events from around the world. You can do so 24 hours a day at voanews.com, as well as on our social media feeds. Just follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. On behalf of the entire team at Flashpoint Ukraine, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America, Washington, D.C.